I'm almost afraid to say anything more after that introduction. I can only disappoint you now. Eric, thank you very much for that introduction. It's really a great pleasure to be here. I can't help but begin by saying my grandparents actually used to live in Maine. They lived in the northernmost point of this state, so far north from here, actually, in a town called Van Buren. Has anyone heard of Van Buren, Maine? My grandparents had a home up there. When my grandfather's father, so when my great-grandfather came to the United States, he came from Russia as a tailor. It's a very typical story. Came to New York City and found there were no jobs for tailors in New York City. So he worked on what was one of the first railroad lines that came up here, and found there were no tailors in northern Maine for the French Acadian farmers. So my mother and grandparents grew up in northern Maine as the only Jewish family among French Acadian farmers. And I have vague recollections as a child of going up to northern Maine and seeing Canada from up here. So it's really a pleasure to be back in that sense. It's a pleasure to be back here and see Eric so well situated. Eric was one of our very best graduate students in Madison. I remember meeting him when I arrived in 2001. And you're very lucky to have him as a professor and teacher here. And I want to thank the History Department, the History Club, and the University for inviting me. It's really, as I said, a great pleasure to be here. I'm going to talk a little bit about my book about Henry Kissinger, and I'm going to talk a little bit also about how a historian thinks about a figure like Henry Kissinger, and how a historian can think about many of the foreign policy issues that surrounded his life. One of the reasons I love being a historian is because by studying the past, we understand the present better. I like historians who are presentist, which is to say I like historians who try to enlighten the way we think about the present. We as historians, and certainly this historian, cannot predict the future. If I could, I wouldn't be here right now. But we can help us understand how we came to where we are today. We can help us understand the decisions that made our world, and we can help us understand the alternatives that were not pursued, alternatives of better or worse worlds that were not pursued. The world did not have to look the way it looks today. It looks the way it does today because certain people made certain decisions at certain moments. And historians can help us understand that. Help us understand that if we're talking about the Cold War. Help us understand that if we're thinking about race relations. Help us understand that if we're thinking about the war in Iraq and Afghanistan and the new administration. Those are all historical as well as contemporary issues. And my book about Henry Kissinger is really an extended effort to do that, to think about our present in the context of the last century. And that's the cover of the book. One of the reasons we chose this cover was because to this day, Henry Kissinger remains the one figure who has appeared most on Time magazine covers. Isn't that amazing? More than presidents. One thing I've started doing when I travel, which my wife says I do far too much of, is when I'm sitting on airplanes to ask people what they think of Gerald Ford. How many people know who Gerald Ford was? Right. It was not everyone doesn't even know who Gerald Ford was. He was president of the United States, ladies and gentlemen. Most people have almost no opinion about him. Right? In fact, John Updike once famously said, right, Gerald Ford seemed to sleep through the presidency, right? Which Chevy Chase thought for Saturday Night Live, he just stumbled through the presidency, right? Everyone has an opinion about Henry Kissinger, better known than many American presidents, though he was never elected to any office. In the most self-consciously democratic society, the society that claims to be more democratic than any other, one of the most recognized and powerful figures is someone who was never elected to any office at any time in his career. That's, in a sense, what we're seeing in this photo, I think, of him in this Time magazine cover. Now, that was my second choice in covers. Here was the cover I really wanted to use. Kissinger as Tony Soprano. It's really a shame the Sopranos are no longer sort of making new episodes because this has lost some of its force in that. But there is something interesting about this, right? There is something ethnic about it. There's something quintessentially American about it, as there is about the Sopranos story. Kissinger is not Italian, of course, but Kissinger is part of an ethnic blending in American society, as I am and so many of you. Kissinger is an outsider and an insider, right? Isn't that the story of the Sopranos, right? They live what look like ordinary family lives, yet they're gangsters at the same time, right? They're inside in the American suburban dream, but they're outside because they have funny accents and they do things that we think run against the American dream. Those are two of the same things. Those are not contradictions. Those are part of American society. If nothing else in my lecture today, remember that point, that one of the things that makes American society run is that it is a certain sensibility about democracy within, blended with a certain adherence to behaviors that run against democratic practice. Those two things go hand in hand. I'll argue today that that is the American century, a constant struggle, a constant blending, a constant effort to build a democratic society, but at the same time, to be a leader in the world, to exert power in ways that seem quintessentially undemocratic at the same time. And that's an unresolved dilemma. That's a dilemma that's led to great American expansion, great American wealth. We're all living with that wealth right now. Most of us have clothing that came from another part of the world made by people who earn far less than we could ever imagine earning in our lives. So we live better because of that wealth and expansion. But we have also, at the same time, we have also, through that wealth and expansion, changed the nature of our own democracy. Expansion has been about external and internal change working hand in hand. And Henry Kissinger's life is a manifestation of that. I will argue that Kissinger's influence is not only because he's smart, and he certainly is, not only because he's ambitious, and he certainly is, but because he captures that blending. He understood, better than most people around him, the power that could come from bringing these things together, from bringing the outside and the inside, the democratic and the non-democratic, the old and the new, together at a period of transformation. And maybe that's my career advice to all of you. Right? The way to succeed in life, it seems to me, is to work at the boundaries between fields and bring fields together. Genius, Einstein himself once said, is more synthesis than analysis. More synthesis than analysis. And Kissinger is the consummate synthesizer in his life, in his politics, in his behavior, and in so much more. So I'm going to talk about this in three different ways for the next half an hour or so, and then I really hope we'll have discussion. I think Eric said that you all have strong opinions and you're ready to talk, so hopefully we'll have a good discussion. I'm going to talk a little bit about transatlantic identity. What does it mean to be part of a transatlantic community and to make foreign policy and to live a life in those terms? I think that helps us understand who Henry Kissinger was, where his ideas came from, helps us understand how our society changed. I will argue that American society became a transatlantic society in the 20th century, and that had good and bad attributes, limits and expansive qualities. Then I want to talk about Cold War knowledge, the ways in which what we came to know changed. We don't know everything, and we don't ask questions about everything. There are certain questions we ask and certain questions we don't ask. Certain things we think we know, and certain things we think we don't know. Why is that? Why did certain kinds of knowledge producers gain power while others didn't? Will be the question I'll ask. And then finally, I want to talk about the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, because I think where we are today in our foreign policy and where Kissinger is and his continued influence in our foreign policy is a manifestation of many of these changes, many of these blendings, many of these intersections that we see in Kissinger's life. So let me begin with this transatlantic identity issue and talk a little bit about where Henry Kissinger came from. This is home in Fürth, Germany, where he grew up. This is in the Jewish ghetto in the town of Fürth, which is in Bavaria, just outside of Nuremberg. How many people have heard of Nuremberg? Right, what have you heard of from Nuremberg? I'm going to take a chance here. What have you guys heard of from Nuremberg? Why do you guys know the name? The Nuremberg trials? Okay, what were the Nuremberg trials about? Good. Excellent. What's your name? Andy. Thank you, Andy. Excellent answer, right? The Nuremberg trials were the post-World War II trials for the Nazi war criminals, as they were termed. There were a set of trials in Tokyo as well. They occurred in Nuremberg. Nuremberg was chosen as the place. The actual court is about 15 minutes on the train from what you're looking at right here. They were chosen. That spot was chosen because that was seen as the heartland of Nazism, right? Many of the largest Nazi rallies were the famous Nuremberg rallies. If you watch the History Channel, which I tell my undergraduates is really the Wehrmacht channel, the Nazi channel, right? Every day, anytime, you can see Nazis marching down Unter den Linden, right? If you watch the History Channel, right, you will see the Nuremberg rallies performed for you. There was these amazingly huge million-person rallies designed to mobilize people behind the Nazi cause and to go out and kill Jews. Kissinger grew up as an Orthodox Jew in a community attached to that community. He grew up in the heartland of the beast, in a sense. Fürth was a what we would call suburb, but it was a town unto itself, not that much larger than Saco. Am I pronouncing that right? S-A-C-O? Than Saco. Not that much larger than Saco. But a major merchant community, a market town, where there were a lot of Jews living on the outskirts of one of the heartlands of Nazism in Germany. Kissinger grew up in this community. He spent most of his time going to Orthodox synagogue and in Orthodox Jewish circles. His father was a very respected teacher in the community. In fact, taught the non-Jews many of the classics of Germany. And the Kissinger family, like so many others, so many other Jewish families, believed that they were German first and Jewish second, even though they were Orthodox Jews. They believed they were attached to the greatness of German culture, and that German culture would make them citizens in a modern world, despite their Jewish background. Kissinger's father taught the classics. The Kissingers grew up in the Jewish ghetto. They had a two-room apartment. It's the window open there that's slightly open. That's their apartment. Two-room apartment. They had hardly any clothing or furniture, but they had the classic works of Goethe. They had a piano, and they had musical instruction from the youngest of age. Right? They were to be in touch with the classics of German society. But when the Nazis came to power, this dream ended very, very quickly. And I think you can even see this on their faces here. This is 1975. The family leaves Fürth in 1938, just before Kristallnacht, which is one of the largest anti-Jewish riots that really kicks off the beginning of the Holocaust in many ways in Germany. They left just before that. This is 1975. It's about 40 years later. Kissinger had been back many times before, but this is the first time his parents had been back after leaving as refugees. I think you can kind of see the bittersweetness on their faces. Louis Kissinger, the Kissinger lookalike at the end, even shorter than Henry. Louis Kissinger gave a speech in 1975 on this return, saying that this time in Fürth, those were the best years of my life, but I never got those years back. I never returned to the life I lived before. Kissinger himself had returned in 1975 after fleeing in 1938 from Nazism, returned triumphantly as the American Secretary of State, was asked in the preparation for his visit by the German ambassador to the United States if they could arrange for him to meet with his old friends, his old soccer club. Kissinger had been a big soccer player when he was young. He had been very involved in various local societies, hiking societies and others, and he was asked by the German ambassador for the kindest of reasons, for diplomatic reasons, if they could arrange meetings with his friends. To which Kissinger's response was, well, that would be nice, but they are all soap now. None of them survived. 11 of Kissinger's relatives were killed in the Holocaust, including his maternal grandparents and others. This area where Kissinger came from was an area of great learning. It was an area of civilization. It was also an area of hatred. It was an area of democracy and violence at the same time. For Kissinger, democracy and violence went hand in hand. The Nazis who forced his family to leave were actually popularly elected. Everyone was not a Nazi. Most people were not killers. But nobody stood up against them. I spent a whole summer in this community researching what went on there, reading the local newspapers. This is what historians do. We go into a place and we read people's mail, right? Finding the old letters, finding the old newspapers, talking to survivors. And I'll tell you, what's extraordinary about this community is how learned it was, how wealthy it was. These were Jews living in ghettos who had made a lot of money as merchants, but how unable they were to organize any kind of resistance. And their friends, those who worked with them, those who went to their offices, those who Kissinger's father educated, those who were not Jewish killers, did not stand up when the Jewish killers came to town. There is no evidence of any organized resistance against the Nazi killing. There is no evidence that everyone joined in either. What there is evidence that most citizens in this community and in others acted as we do, which is to say they watched, they argued, they complained, but they did very little. about it. This is the international equivalent of the Kitty Genovese scenario. How many people have heard of Kitty Genovese? Kitty Genovese was a woman, a young woman in New York City, who was raped in public view. I think it's now 3 decades ago or so. Raped in the courtyard of an apartment building. Raped at about 5 o'clock in the afternoon in the spring. People around the building in various apartments watched the scenario. Nobody called the police. Nobody called the police. After the fact, the police came by and asked, why didn't you call the police? These were good families. There were kids watching, in fact. Everyone said, this was horrible what was happening, but I thought someone else would take care of it. I thought someone else would take care of it. Not my business. Not my business. I'll watch, but I won't get involved. This was the experience that Kissinger had of democracy. Weimar Germany had more political parties than the United States. The Nazis won as much as 38% of the vote. They had a plurality, not a majority, but a plurality, and in this community they won about 45% of the vote. This was a society that was vibrant in its democracy, at least until 1933. And it was a society where the Democrats did not stand up against mass violence. A society where democracy led to complacency, not to strong protection of individuals. I spent some time talking to Kissinger about this. There we are, in fact. That's the entrance to his building here. I had met with him once before I went in 2004, and he told me that FERT had no meaning to him. I was wasting my time. So, of course, I went anyway. I had a grant. I had to use the money. So I went, and while I was there, he happened to make a visit, not because I was there, but because it's important to him. Right? He was there, and I happened to run into him there. I knew he was coming only because I was spending all my time in the archive. And the archivist in this small Jewish archive, and as a historian, spend a lot of time in archives. You get to know archivists very, very well. It's a kind of nerdy life, but it's fun nonetheless. And the archivist happened to be the girlfriend of the local news photographer who was arranged to photograph Kissinger when he came. So I went and stalked him for a couple hours and talked to him there a little bit. Here he is not listening to me, as usual. My wife also says this is another example of my being poorly dressed for any occasion. Right? I mean, I was supposed to be working in the archive that morning when I found out he was coming, so I'm just in a T-shirt and jeans. I did have clean underwear on. Here we are at the State Department after my book came out, and here he's now instructing me on all the things I need to correct. You can see how interesting this is. Here we were in New York talking about the book. I show you these pictures. Because I like showing these pictures, but I show you these pictures also because they give you a sense of how engaged with these issues he is. And one thing that comes out when you talk to someone like Henry Kissinger is how much the past is the present for him. These issues are ever present with him. At this meeting, which was in New York City, we did a kind of discussion about my book about him at the New York Historical Society. It was in March of 2008. That was during the Democratic primaries. It wasn't clear yet whether it was going to be Obama or Hillary as the Democratic nominee. Henry was working for McCain, but, of course, watching what was going on the Democratic side. And I asked him what he thought of Obama, and what he said was very revealing. He said, well, Obama is an incredibly interesting person, and it's great how he's mobilized people, but that's dangerous. Hitler mobilized people, too. That's a direct quotation from someone who knows very well that Obama is not Hitler. But that fear of crowds, that fear of mass action, that sense of what mass politics is. He's never lost from when he was a kid. Right? That is something none of us would ever say, because we don't experience crowds in those ways. He experiences crowds in those ways. This is the home in Leutershausen, which is a godforsaken little town outside of Fürth, where his grandparents lived. They were cattle merchants. They were wealthy cattle merchants. They lived in this house. In 1938, in October of 1938, 2 months before Kristallnacht, the Nazis in the town came and attacked this house. This was a house Kissinger used to go to on weekends. Luckily, he wasn't there. In the archive, I found 2 memoirs of people who were in the house, including a maid. The house was attacked. Kissinger's parents were forced to flee with an hour's notice. His grandfather died of a heart attack within a day, and his grandmother died in the camps, one of the first in his family to be gassed by the Nazis. Kissinger never lost that memory. And when he came to the United States, he came in 1938 not as someone seeking in the United States to join what he saw as the best society. He was not a voluntary immigrant. to the United States. He spoke no English and had no reason to want to come to the United States. He came to the United States because it was the only place his family could come to escape the horror. And they were lucky enough to be able to come because they had some family here. Many others were not so lucky. When Kissinger came to the United States, he did not assimilate as an American. He went to George Washington High School in New York City, but his life surrounded Orthodox synagogue, and he lived in Washington Heights, Manhattan, north of Columbia University, a part of Manhattan I had never visited, even though I grew up there, until I did research on this project, because my family comes from Russian Jewish origins. That's the Lower East Side. The German Jews were in Washington Heights. They lived in a separate community, a separate community. Kissinger only became an American by his own terms and literally as a citizen because of World War II. And that's a really important point I want everyone to understand here. World War II made him an American citizen. He's drafted into the army, for the first time taken out of an Orthodox Jewish household, for the first time given citizenship, and for the first time given a role in American society. Before he went in the army, he was going to night school at City College for a year, studying to be an accountant, and he was working in a brush factory during the day, cleaning brushes with acid to make money for his family. In the army, however, he immediately gets promoted very quickly. Promoted not because people trust him or like him, they never did, and he's not a very likable guy. But he gets promoted in the army because he has two attributes that the United States needs that it values in World War II that it never valued before. He's not American. He understands German society. And the United States is desperate in 1942 to begin to understand German society better because of the perception that the American military is at some point soon going to have to occupy and remake German society. Secondly, he's Jewish, which means he's not allowed in all the clubs. He's not allowed in the officer clubs. He cannot become a physician in the doctor. He had applied to become a physician in the army, and he's not allowed to because of the quota at the time. But because he's Jewish, he can be trusted to be anti-Nazi. They don't trust his Americanness, but they trust he will not side with the Nazis. So he is sent in 1944 and 45 to Germany, Americanized, serving in the U.S. Army in Germany. Just think about that for a second. He becomes an American by serving in the most hierarchical, undemocratic institution within our society in occupation of another society. That's how his Americanness is defined. He spends his early formative years not in college, like you. He spends his early formative years not at home with his parents, not in New York City, but in the very society that forced him to flee and that killed 11 of his relatives. He's put in charge of two towns, Krefeld and Bensheim, in large part because the American military is short of staff, and they need people who know something about these areas. He's put in charge of overseeing towns and protecting Germans, the same Germans who have attacked his family in many ways. And his career takes off from there. It's that experience that opens up American society and opens up a career for Henry Kissinger. It's that moment that American society becomes blended to Europe as it had not been before. There had been thousands, millions of immigrants from Europe coming to the United States and immigrants coming from elsewhere. But the United States had never taken on an occupation of that size in another society of that strategic importance, of that depth, with that kind of commitment before. This is far more than Cuba or the Philippines or Puerto Rico. This is now a major American occupation and a recalibration of American interests and American power. Kissinger's Europeanness becomes a ticket to his ascension within American society. He's hired in 1946 by the Army as a lecturer to lecture without a college degree to Army officers on German society, to instruct them about German society. And then he's admitted to Harvard in a special class that Harvard creates in the middle of the 1947 school year, specially created for servicemen, particularly Jewish GIs coming back, paid for by the U.S. government through the GI Bill. Never before had that happened. The government plays a direct role in encouraging the Europeanization of academics. And Kissinger's career is built on that henceforth. At Harvard, he's not admitted into the history program to get his PhD or his undergraduate degree. Only good Americans can do that. If you look actually at history departments, it's not till the late 50s that Jews are actually hired in history departments. But Kissinger is pushed into this new field called international studies that did not exist before. This new field called international studies. And this new field of international studies has new centers, like the Center for International Affairs. Here's a picture of their group, where Kissinger's internationalism, his cross between societies, will be a source of influence. He immediately is seen as someone who has practical knowledge and policy knowledge that's important for the United States in its new international role. So think about that for a second. Our policies have changed, and now the most local thing you can think of, education, has changed as well. And power has changed. Money has changed. This center is funded not by tuition dollars at Harvard, not by money from local communities, not by traditional Harvard endowment money. It's funded by the CIA. It's funded by the Ford Foundation, working on behalf of the U.S. government, and it's funded directly by the Pentagon. The government plays a new role in encouraging an internationalization of American society, and vice versa. What this means is that the transatlanticization of American society is much more about the United States making strategic commitments to Europe. It's about American identity being redefined in transatlantic terms. Jews become white because Jews are part of a new transatlantic world. Jews gain some admission. They're still outsiders. They're still not fully in the club. But they're now part of this community in a way they were not before. But African Americans and women and others are still not included in this. Certain groups get access and certain groups don't. Certain groups get access for certain purposes and certain groups don't. So it's not a simple story of exclusion and inclusion. It's a more complicated story, and it's connected to international change as well as domestic. Without World War II, there is no Henry Kissinger. And without Henry Kissinger and what his world represents, there's no Cold War. These are deeply interrelated topics. The social history of immigrants is the international history of American foreign policy, and vice versa. This is absolutely crucial when later on Kissinger deals with Vietnam. Because the problem in Vietnam for Kissinger is never Vietnam. If he had ever thought about Vietnam, he would not have made the stupid mistakes he made there. Vietnam for Kissinger was about protecting European credibility and imperial interests. The concern that the United States had, that Kissinger had continuously, was that countries like France, initially, would lose their empire and be replaced by communist states, states that looked like Nazism to Kissinger. And his concern after the United States took over in Vietnam was if the United States did not play a strong role, that the extremists in countries like the Soviet Union would feel they had the upper hand and the United States would lose its credibility. For Kissinger, the problem in Germany was that the good people were not strong enough. And his emphasis in foreign policy became an emphasis upon strength and an emphasis upon a European sense of interest that the United States brought to other parts of the world. This is different from traditional colonialism, but you could argue it has colonial, certainly imperial elements to it. I'll say more about that in a few minutes. Let me move on to the second topic I wanted to talk a little bit about that relates to this, which is Cold War knowledge. How do we know what we know and not know what we don't know? Why do certain ideas get prevalence over others? Haven't you noticed that? Right? Certain ideas get more prominence than others. Certain ideas don't get voice. You hear interesting ideas of certain kinds, and they just don't appear in the newspaper after a while. Maybe they're on sort of small blogs, but they don't get national prominence. Why is that? Why do certain things get prominence and others don't? Well, I think one of the most important things we have to think about when we look at this picture is how the Cold War and the aftermath of World War II changed intellectual life and changed daily education within our society. This change, I think, occurred not because anyone was conspiratorial, but because the purposes of education and the purposes of social life were now redefined. Before World War II, most universities were pretty self-enclosed entities. Even the University of Wisconsin, where we pride ourselves as having been the engine of state reform, we created Social Security, we created workmen's compensation. We really did. We created the New Deal in Madison and everything else that was good. We created it, right? Even though we make that claim, the truth of the matter is that education was a pretty self-enclosed entity. In the 1930s, presidents were not generally invited to go speak at university commencements. In fact, when FDR wanted to go in 1936 to speak at the Harvard commencement, many of the faculty at Harvard voted against him doing that. They didn't want the president to come. The problem was he was an alum, so they couldn't actually keep him from coming, right? They didn't want him to come. They defined themselves against politics. The model was that knowledge was about ivory towers. That to be a smart person, you had to be disinterested. You couldn't be corrupted by power, right? That you should be separate. And universities tried to keep themselves separate. That's what academic freedom is all about, right? After World War II, this changed because during the war, the government took over universities, all universities. There were no men to go to school, right? They were all off fighting. They had been drafted. Those who were educated on campuses were educated as military officers paid for by the U.S. government. And it never changed after that. After World War II, universities, even small universities, became part of a larger federal structure of education that's connected to real-world policy influences. Now, that had enormously positive effects in some respects. It created a pool of intellectual knowledge of people who wouldn't have been admitted before. This picture includes not only Henry Kissinger, it includes Zbigniew Brzezinski, it includes Henry Rowan, who later became a Nobel Prize-winning economist, it includes Thomas Schelling, many major figures in American life, many major figures who were crucial in nuclear strategy, crucial in thinking about developmental economics, crucial in thinking about game theory, crucial in thinking about environmentalism. Thomas Schelling is one of the first people to write about environmentalism, in fact, on a large scale. So the pooling of that talent and the use of that talent for practical purposes was a great outcome. But it was also a dangerous outcome because it closed off other avenues of inquiry. It closed off other perspectives. Coming out of the Cold War, it became very difficult to be an academic advocate of social democracy. It became very difficult to be an academic advocate of the restraint of American power. It became very difficult to criticize certain policies as well, because quite frankly, the money flowed from those policies. Money flowed from those policies. This was not a conspiracy. No one intended it as such, but it is what came of this. McCarthyism was an extreme moment in this phenomenon, but it was not the only moment. And to this day, you should ask yourself where the money that goes to large research universities comes from. The largest single source of funding for major research in the United States is the Pentagon. It's the largest single source of funding within the United States. It is the source of big science, stem cells on down, and it is also the source of policy-relevant knowledge. And that's a change in the intellectual life of our society. It makes Kissinger who he is, because Kissinger becomes the consummate bridge figure from the academics to the policymakers. He's never actually tenured as a traditional academic. He's tenured in this nebulous area of international affairs, between fields. And his knowledge base, his influence, comes from that. He's brought into the Truman administration to comment on Germany. Because of his German experience and his academic background, he can help the Truman administration, when it's thinking about what it calls psychological warfare, understand German society. He's brought in by Dwight Eisenhower to brief the president on nuclear strategy. He can bring the best knowledge of nuclear strategy to the making of policy. He's brought in by John F. Kennedy during the Berlin crisis of 1961 to help understand German reactions to Berlin and the division of Berlin. He's brought in by Lyndon Johnson to help with the negotiations in Vietnam, because he can bring the best academic knowledge on negotiations and American foreign policy together with the actual process of negotiations. And he's brought in by Richard Nixon as National Security Advisor because Nixon wants to mobilize the best knowledge, but he wants to own it. He doesn't want to have to go consult professors. He wants to own one, make one of them work for him. This is the strength and this is the weakness of this system. Because as Sam Rayburn, who was Speaker of the House in the late 1960s, said to Lyndon Johnson, he said, "Lyndon, the problem is not brains. These guys are the smartest we've ever had in Washington. And the problem is not hard work. These guys are the hardest workers we've ever had in Washington." They were hard workers. "But the problem, Lyndon," Sam Rayburn said from rural Texas, "is that none of these guys have ever been elected county sheriff. They don't actually know the first thing about how to run a society." The mobilization of knowledge in American society after World War II was a mobilization of intellectual talent, but intellectual talent disconnected from actual social experience, disconnected from the lives of many other people. It was an undemocratic transformation of American society that happened before our eyes. And again, no one planned it that way, but is the reality of what happened. Foreign policy was less connected than it had ever been before from daily political practice, from daily democracy. And think about how foreign policy is made today. It's not just the imperial presidency. There is a whole apparatus called the National Security Council that operates out of the White House, unelected, unconfirmed members of the administration who will set the stage for much of American policy, right? They don't even have to report to Congress. James Jones, the new National Security Advisor, seems a very capable person. He doesn't even have to report to Congress on what he does. He is not in a position where Congress has any oversight for him. He works personally for the president. He has a whole apparatus that organizes foreign policy. What Jones will do is he will control all the information from the State Department and Defense Department that comes in to the presidency, right? That did not exist before. That arena is populated by people like this, populated by people like this. And they're not bad people. It's not a conspiracy. It's a transformation in the way American society is organized. It is an undemocratic consequence of the internationalization of American society. Here's the best graphic example of this. It's a graph I think historians 20 years from now will look at with perplexed eyes. This is the nuclear balance. I made this graph, which is why it's not as pretty as it should be. It's the nuclear balance between the United States and the Soviet Union. Right? Look how far ahead the United States is all the way through. Now, I kind of cooked the books, because in 72, the Soviets start to get a little closer. Right? But in fact, the United States has an incredible lead in terms of the number of nuclear weapons. And we all know, I mean, once you get above 6,000 of these things, what do you get by having 6,500 versus 6,000? Can you just blow up the world one more time? Right? The delivery vehicles matter. Are they ready to be delivered on time? Do you have an ability to make it impossible for someone else to knock out all your weapons first? But that's really about delivery vehicles. That's not about the amount of warheads you have. You don't need that many warheads to destroy the world and make it impossible for your enemy to really think they can beat you. Right? But yet, this continues to grow. During the period of so-called détente in the late 1960s and 1970s. Why is this? I would argue to you that the reason it grows is about everything I've said to you today. Nuclear weapons became the symbolic capital of American power and Soviet power in the Cold War. What do I mean by symbolic capital? No one wanted to use them. No one thought they served any social utility. No one believed they made anyone's life any better. None of that. But they became a way for the empowered people who were controlling policy for good reason to be able to show strength to others. They were a way of measuring strength and controlling information. Power became the ability to manipulate information, manipulate symbols, intimidate and deter rather than create. Intimidate and deter rather than create. And this made some sense in a Cold War world, but I would argue to you, we never worked our way out of that. And that's the last set of points I want to talk about. I want to talk a little bit about Iraq and Afghanistan, and I want to actually begin with Chile as I talk about that. One of the darkest spots in Kissinger's career, one of the things he's often accused of being a war criminal for, is the assassination of Salvador Allende in Chile in 1973 and the creation of one of the most horrific governments that the United States associated itself with, the government of Augusto Pinochet, that through the 1970s and 80s was responsible for literally rounding up thousands of its own citizens and disappearing them, meaning they would just disappear. No one would ever hear from them. They wouldn't even know if their father had died or not. You just would never hear back from them. And this was a society that received extraordinary American aid and support. And the coup against Allende was a coup that was, at the very least, supported by the U.S. As I discuss in the book, the United States gave direct aid to the military factions that sought to overthrow Allende because of his connections to Castro and the Soviet Union. The United States not only gave support to those seeking to overthrow Allende, the United States did active things to bring the Allende government down. We published newspapers there going after the Allende government, sought to bring the economy down, to close it off to access to loans and markets. We did everything we could to bring that government down. And then after that government fell and this horrific regime was created, Kissinger continued to work with this regime. The lesson Kissinger was applying was a lesson not about democracy in Chile. It was a lesson about strength and force. Kissinger believed that for all the bad things that happened in Chile, that it was less bad than having communist, fascist, Nazi-like influence in that part of the world. He believed, Kissinger did, that the United States had to choose between the unruly, dangerous violence of extremist ideologies and a clean democratic approach that was impractical. And in choosing, we should choose to use force to prevent those extremes from coming to power. And the depth of danger from those extremes for him justified the use of these horrific means. The ends justified the means for him. And I would argue to you that this impulse came from a legitimate moral impulse from his experiences in World War II, but it was a legitimate moral impulse that went too far. Or another way of putting that is this was a case of moral self-righteousness gone amok. It was not that Henry Kissinger believed that everything could go. He was not a realist, in fact. He was someone who morally believed that the extremes of danger from Nazism and communism justified undemocratic behavior, and his entire career was about that. Notice everything I've said about his career, right? He is always connected to non-democratic institutions, always connected in his promotion through institutions that are about mobilizing talent and mobilizing money and force, not mobilizing public opinion. Public opinion is dangerous for Kissinger. The public were the people who went out and killed the Jews, right? The smart ones were the ones who should control politics. I asked Kissinger once why he never throughout his career that I could find, had any deep relationship or comment on the civil rights movement. Why did he not in any way take a position on those issues? Historically, if you've read any of this, there's an argument made that Jews and African Americans often work together for civil rights because they see themselves having mutual benefit in this. And then later on, other groups join a larger coalition of civil rights activists. And they were major ministers and rabbis and others involved in the civil rights marches. Why didn't Kissinger get involved in this? And his response was a simple and honest one, though perhaps horrific to us. He said, "Those people who were marching, I believed in what they were marching for. But marchers were never good for my people. What did they do for me? Everywhere I came, everywhere I went, it was because not of popular action, but of enlightened government." Enlightened government. For Kissinger, strength and effective policy came from enlightened leaders who made tough choices, not from popular action. Popular action was dangerous. Enlightened, meritocratic leaders were the ones who should make the decisions. And that, I would argue, is exactly the kind of thinking that got us into Iraq and Afghanistan in the way we went in there. I think they were actually very good reasons to go to war in Iraq, but they were not the reasons we gave, and they were not the reasons we conducted that war. We went into Iraq believing that we could lead from afar, that enlightened government could change life on the ground, and that enlightened government was legitimate because we told ourselves we were enlightened. It's the same mistake Kissinger made in Chile. It's the same mistake he made in Chile. The same thing that allowed him to justify what were unjustifiable crimes committed in our name, and unjustifiable crimes were similarly committed in Iraq. Enlightened government can be dangerous as well as good. Kissinger and his followers in the Bush administration also applied the wrong lessons from World War II and the Cold War, the lessons that strength and the manipulation of information were justified in higher purposes, right? And it was that show of strength, that excessive show of strength, and that excessive manipulation of information, because people always manipulate information, but this was just excessive in a sense, that excessive manipulation of information delegitimized exactly what they were doing. No one would ever believe again anything they said in their foreign policy aims. They fell into a process of acting with so much force and so much self-confidence and so much self-righteousness that they undermined the very things they thought they were fighting for. And finally, I would argue, that what Kissinger fell into also was a sense in which the United States could do no wrong. Chile was justifiable, and he justifies it to this day, just as Afghanistan and Iraq were, because the United States was a force inherently for goodness for Kissinger. And I actually believe that. I actually think the United States is a force for goodness. I come from immigrants myself, and I wouldn't have had the chance to become a professor from my background in almost any other society. I went to college on scholarship all the way through. My parents couldn't afford to send me. America is a society of opportunity. It is a great place. But what we don't recognize, what Kissinger lost sight of, is it's a great place and it's also a bad place at the same time. We do good things and we do bad things. People see us in different ways. What Kissinger never grappled with, what all those super smart people around him never came to understand, was just because they were smart and saw things one way, other smart people wouldn't necessarily agree. Right? The hardest problem we all have as intellectuals is recognizing that other smart people might disagree with us. We think we're so smart, we have the answer, and that's right, and anyone else who's smart will agree with us. Well, that's not true. And what we've seen in Afghanistan and Iraq are legitimate, I think, voices of difference in what we seek to bring in terms of political change and social change. That's a very basic thing for me to say, but it's something that's very hard for Americans to grapple with. We might think our form of government and leadership is the best, but other people will have reasons to disagree that are legitimate. They are not dumb and deluded if they disagree with us. Our form of government is not the right form of government for everyone, even though it might be good for us, right? And Kissinger and those around him at the time, because they were so smart, never came to understand that. They saw the world through their intellectual lens, not through the lens of other people. They could not appreciate other points of view. For Kissinger, as he said to me, the United States was a salvation. And as a salvation, it was a bright, shining light I had to protect. I think he believed that. That was in the context of why he hated the protesters in the 1960s, in which he said that. I think he believed that. We have to take that seriously, and I respect that. But we also have to respect the views of others who legitimately disagree on those points. And I want to quote in those terms I want to conclude with a quote from Kissinger that I think really captures both the strength and the weakness of his background, both the enlightenment and the danger, both the value and the vice, and also the blending of different things. Kissinger said to me that, you know, the Second World War, Germany, was the most important thing in my life. It affected my ideas about global issues. For one thing, the Second World War and the experience of the Holocaust made me impatient with people like you, he's talking to me, like you, who thought that all you needed to do was sit in some seminar, speak to some students, say some nice things, and make everyone feel good. That works if you're a professor, pointing at me, but it doesn't work if you live in the real world like I do. It sounded like my father now a little bit here, right? I had seen evil in the world. I lived evil in the world. I was there. And I knew that there are some things you have to fight for, and you can't insist that everything fits some perfect professorial model, some ideal construction that you have made. Well, he's right. Very easy for us intellectuals to make the world seem like it should fit a certain impractical model. But he's also wrong in thinking that his own experience of horror justifies the use of other horrors to protect something worse. Where do you draw the line? When do you say that living in a dirty world, a world where we have to roll up our sleeves and do some things we'd rather not like to do, when do you say you've gone too far? Where do you draw the line? That's the question he never answered himself. That's the question this whole group never answered, because they were so imbued with their own knowledge, so imbued with their own sense of American righteousness. It's a question we need to answer. We cannot throw the baby out with the bathwater. The United States is a force of important action and often goodness in the world and at home, but we are far from flawless. Now we have to figure out where we will draw the line. It's the old Hegelian question that I'll close with. How do you pursue universal ideals like democracy, equality, social justice in a diverse world? How do you pursue the ideal without imposing on other points of view? Kissinger went too far. Hopefully we can learn from his successes and his failures in that sense. I'll leave it at that. Thank you. So questions, criticisms?
I think a few people have to leave, obviously, so hopefully a few others will stay. We've got the room, I think, until 1:30, so we have plenty of time for some discussion. So, Paul.
You know, I've always thought that Judaism's gift to the world has been the prophetic, the prophetic tradition. And the prophetic tradition, simplified, is when bad things happen to Israel, Israel needed to look at itself. Sometimes I question that about contemporary Israel.
Me too.
And what about Kissinger? I mean, where was that? That's one question. And the other question, since you know this man, if you were to put Kissinger and Isabel Allende in the same room together, how would he deal with that?
All right, I'll take the... those are two great questions, Paul, and two very difficult questions, so I'll... stumble through them in order here. You're absolutely right. I mean, one of the things that I love about Judaism is this intensive introspection and self-criticism, right? I mean, the joke is that if you have two Jews in a room, you actually have three opinions, right? And there is something to that. And it's definitely there in the Orthodox tradition in particular that he comes out of. And I think there is some of that self-criticism, but I think there's also a fragility about that generation in particular that comes to a new place and that constantly feels it's here but doesn't really belong at the same time. And he's never lost that. He's very self-conscious of his outsiderness even to this day. On the one hand, he's an insider, right? He has access to power in the way none of us do. On the other hand, he's always the kind of odd man out. He's not your traditional American power broker in any sense, right? He doesn't come from an esteemed family. He doesn't fit in the country club setting, and he's very self-conscious of that. I think the years with Rockefeller and Nixon hit him hardest about that. I mean, Rockefeller would have Kissinger do everything for him when Rockefeller was running for governor or president, but Kissinger was never invited to the Rockefeller family parties until he was in the White House, right? He used to carry Rockefeller's luggage while he was writing Rockefeller speeches. I mean, he was Rockefeller's Jew boy. There was no way around. Now, Rockefeller was too much of a gentleman to ever say that to his face. Nixon used him as his Jew boy and actually called him that to his face, too. So he's constantly confronted this throughout his life. And as I mentioned, I think in a footnote I buried in the book, when I told him I was going to discuss this in the book, his first reaction was, aren't you worried about sparking more anti-Semitism today? You know, which I think gave a sense of how sensitive he is to this. I mean, there is anti-Semitism in the world, but I don't worry about it in the way he does. So I think the self-criticism is there deep down, but he's unwilling to show it in public. I think, this is just my impression, I can't prove it, but I think he's a man who's terrified by his own legacy, in a sense. I think he's self-justifying, and he believes he always tried to do the right thing, doesn't see his own personal failures, but he's self-critical of the outcomes. He just won't say that. I don't actually think he really believes he did the right thing in Vietnam or Chile. But I don't think he can ever say that because of this fragility. Whereas someone like McNamara can, in I think a very self-serving way, cry and say we were wrong, terribly wrong, but I was just the good American, grew up in a log cabin. This is how the Errol Morris film goes, right? I grew up in a log cabin. I went to work for the U.S. government during World War II. Then I went to Ford. What could be more American? Leader of Ford, right? And then I went to Washington. I'm just the guy next door. Kissinger can never play that role because of his background, and I think there's a kind of fragility there. So the self-criticism is there, but it's hidden from the public, I think. Then Kissinger and Isabel Allende, I don't know if they've ever met. Probably not. I think if they were together, I think what he would say to her, I don't quite know what she would say, I have some sense, but I think what he would say to her would be, what happened was a terrible tragedy, but it was the outcome of circumstances we could not control. And I think he would make the case that he believed that the Allende government was a dangerous government, but that he never intended for these things to happen personally to Allende. And he would make that separation, which I think is just a debater's separation. When you're going to bring down a government, even if you're not pulling the trigger, you know you're opening the door to that happening. And it would be a dishonest case he'd make. But that's generally, as you know, probably better than I know, that's the case he's generally made to the public, that we were going to bring down this government, but we did not intend to bring on this violence. He is honest about the fact that they knew very little about Pinochet. It wasn't that they knew this was going to be a terribly violent government. They just didn't think it through. In fact, to me, it's even worse. They didn't think about what happens when you take a Latin American society that has an established tradition of civilian control over the military that many other societies don't have, and you go in and you support the military taking control of the civilian apparatus. They were smart enough to know what that would mean, but there's no evidence to me they actually ever thought it through that much. That in no way apologizes, but I think that's the case. That's the way he would try to avoid personal guilt, I think.
Other questions?
I want to save you for posterity.
Did you say Kissinger was an aide to the Bush administration?
Yes, he had a very influential role with the Bush administration at a number of levels. One, he was someone brought in to advise them on the Middle East because of his extensive experience there. I didn't have time to talk about this, but no American figure has had more experience dealing with Middle East leaders than Henry Kissinger. Much of what happened in the early 70s was about that. Go ahead.
So was it part of his idea to, like, conceal it from the American people, like, for the better good? Like, they were doing something good in the world that they knew America wouldn't like, and they did it anyway? Is that kind of...
Well, the way he would put it would be this way. He'd say that there were things the United States had to do that in the short run would leave a distaste in the mouths of American citizens, and we couldn't let that convince us not to do what we had to do. He wouldn't call it secrecy or hiding it. He would call it public persuasion and even necessary manipulation. But yes, he would say that, for example, I mean, he said this publicly, that we shouldn't, even though people had publicly turned against the war, we shouldn't let that change our policy when we still need to fight this way. The same argument he made in Vietnam. And he actually pulled out an old memo he had written for Nixon and gave it to Bush. This is a famous salted peanuts memo where he cautioned Nixon, this is 1970, not to withdraw troops too fast. Because he said, once you start withdrawing troops, it's like salted peanuts. people will want more. They want all the troops out, so we'll have to get out too fast. Whereas what the Nixon administration was doing, was trying to do was calibrate. They were trying to say to the North Vietnamese, you do this for us, and we'll take 100,000 soldiers out. You do this for us, we'll take another. And Kissinger was afraid that once the public saw we could start taking soldiers out, they'd want them all out immediately. That memo, about a five-page memo, he photocopied it, kind of like what we would do as historians, but instead of our photocopying it and putting it in our file boxes, he brought it to Bush and gave it to Bush, literally gave it to him and said, this is what you have to worry about when people start pressuring you to pull troops out of Iraq. And it was after that that Bush decided to actually put more troops in. The surge came after that advice.
Yeah, you already answered my third question. I was going to ask if he thought the American people were not going to realize it, but he knew that they were going to realize that it was distasteful, and he just had to hide it from them so he could get the chance to go in, right?
His argument was that this long-run success would then justify what happened before, and he's not entirely wrong on that. Think about how people have been talking about the surge now, right? In a way, I mean, it was extraordinary, right? Wasn't it during the campaign? Eric and I were talking about this. Professor Zelo and I were talking about this, right, that during the campaign, right, the first debate, Kissinger's name came up in the context of Iran. The other thing that came up in that first debate between McCain and Obama was both were saying the surge was working, right? So after the fact, if you get a result that looks, whether real or not, like it's success, then people forgive, was Kissinger's argument, some of the undemocratic actions en route. And that's what he was hoping would happen in Iraq, as in Vietnam. That's what he was hoping would happen in Chile, too.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just, going back to the Iraq
sure.
War, but I want to go back to the Gulf War and okay. the first Gulf War. What was Kissinger's influence or, you know, what was his take on that, and how much was he involved in that type of thing? And if there was his influence was in there, why did it work the first time? Then it not work the second time? I'm a veteran of the first Gulf War, so I'm just curious. You know, I was there. I saw the war. I was in this, you know, full thrust. So
right.
And I seem to remember Kissinger's name coming up quite a few times. Listening to the Armed Forces Network, AFN.
Sure.
You know, we used to listen
sure.
to all that stuff all the time
sure.
before everything kicked off. So.
Sure. Well, one of the very positive influences he had on the first Gulf War that you probably remember is he played a strong role encouraging Bush Sr. To get involved in the diplomacy of the Middle East. He made it very clear, and I think Bush knew this already, but Kissinger reinforced and helped him to pursue a policy that was not about the United States acting alone. Even though you know better than I do that the military force was predominantly American military force, but Bush Sr. was able to create the appearance and the reality of a true coalition of societies that were working together there. For one thing, he got other societies to pay American costs. We actually got the Japanese and the Kuwaitis to pay us to do this, so the money didn't come out of our economy, for example. And he was able to get a UN resolution on behalf of this. He was able to get a NATO resolution on behalf of this. He was able to get Syria to go along with it, if you remember the discussions with Assad at the time. And Kissinger's argument was that the United States acts most effectively when it builds a coalition of states with strong leaders who can work together. And he played an active role in helping Bush make some of those contacts. The thing we have to recognize about Kissinger is those connections he makes early on as an international figure and an academic and policy figure, those networks he builds are a source of enduring power. That's why he remains so influential so long. Just think, I was saying this to Professor Zelo before, when one of you is elected president, right, the first thing you're going to want to do is figure out what other people in the world are thinking. And you're going to try to find people who know other people in the world. Kissinger is the natural person you look to because he spent so much time through his career meeting with all these people, meeting with Assad, meeting with the Kuwaiti leadership, meeting with the Saudi leadership, meeting with Hu Jintao. And now he runs his consulting company by continuing to do that. So you're Coca-Cola and you want to sell Coke in China, you hire Henry Kissinger to get you a meeting with Hu Jintao. You're Barack Obama, you want to know what Hu Jintao was thinking about economic change, you want to hear what happened in that meeting, so you ask Henry Kissinger to come and talk to you. So he played a role in helping Bush Sr., I think, do one of the greatest things Bush Sr. did, was work together in a coalition.